En el americano definitivamente nunca se usó y no, por alguna razón, nunca jamás volvió a sonar ese teléfono. El mexicano sonaba y sonaba, pero nunca contestaba nuestras llamadas. Se llega al otro día, mi madre, con la esperanza de que haya cruzado, llamamos a la compañía que se supone se tenía que reportar a las 9:40 de la mañana con su supervisora en la compañía Swift. Nos dicen que no, que nunca llegó, no se ha presentado, y ellos también intentaron hablarle personalmente y nunca nadie contestó su teléfono. Hasta el día de hoy, nunca nadie ha contestado el teléfono.
Maribel González, otra hermana del desaparecido.
Es como si la tierra se lo hubiese tragado. Su desaparición de él fue el 27 de marzo. Nosotros sabemos que él está vivo porque es el presentimiento de que tenemos de él. Él, donde quiera que esté, él nos va a escuchar. Y si por medio de esa comunicación él nos pudiera escuchar, Andrés, donde quiera que te encuentres, mi madre, mis hermanas, la familia entera te está esperando con los brazos abiertos. Solamente si yo puedo decirte por medio de esto que seas fuerte, que tengas fe, que te estamos esperando, que donde quiera que estés, siempre te tenemos en nuestra alma, en nuestros pensamientos. La familia dejó de ser feliz desde que tú no estás, pero te seguimos esperando. No sabemos cuándo ni cuándo, solo Dios Todopoderoso nos va a dar ese día. Y donde quiera que estés, recuerda que te queremos mucho y que te recordamos, y que hasta ahora sabemos lo más importante que eres el hermano perfecto, que te extrañamos, que te queremos, y si este medio va a llegar a tus oídos, a las personas que te tengan, que Dios les ablande su corazón y que sepan que tú tienes familia que te espera acá y que nosotros te queremos con toda el alma. Yo no voy a reprocharle a la vida, ni a la ley de México, ni a la ley de Estados Unidos. Solo le pido justicia por Dios, y Él es el único que te va a liberar donde quiera que estés, donde quiera que tú estés. Que Dios quiera que esta comunicación, o por medio de esta comunicación, tú nos estés escuchando, que te adoramos y que te estamos esperando con los brazos abiertos. Te queremos mucho, hermano, y que Diosito te cuide donde quiera que estés, y que seas muy fuerte y que tengas fe. Muchísimas gracias a esta comunicación, y que Dios te proteja donde quiera que estés, hermano. Que Diosito te cuide.
Era Maribel González, que rehúsa darse por vencida en su búsqueda por su hermano desaparecido. Concluye esta edición del informativo Pacífica. Agradecemos la colaboración de todas las personas que hicieron posible este programa. A nombre de Norma Martínez, se despide tu amigo de siempre, Fernando Velázquez. Gracias por acompañarnos.
Santa Cruz Free Fucking Radio. Get rad.
From the cream to the dregs. From the cream to the dregs. From the cream to the dregs. Every Thursday night from 8 to 11. From the cream to the dregs. From the cream to the dregs. Check it out. It's old-time music, new-time music. It's mostly fun, and it's just for you right here on Free Radio Santa Cruz. The Free Radio Station.
Take this, brother. May it serve you well.
Hey, this is from Berlin, specifically for Skid Mark Bob. Anarchy is dead, and so is freedom of speech. And if you don't believe it, you guys got your head up your fucking asses. And you can't play this on the air. You guys are fucking full of shit. Anarchy and freedom of speech is a myth. You guys are full of shit.
Help us. Freak Radio Santa Cruz needs your help. Freak Radio Santa Cruz needs your help. It costs a lot of money to run an unlicensed radio station and keep the independent information, music, and expression going 24 hours a day for the last 10 years. Please consider donating to your favorite pirate radio station by making a check payable to Free Radio Santa Cruz, or just FRSC, mail it to P.O. Box
7811,
Santa Cruz, California 95061. You could also PayPal through our website, www.freakradio.org. That's freakradio.org. Help us! Santa Cruz needs your help. Again, make all checks payable to FRSC and mailmen to P.O. Box
7811,
Santa Cruz, California 95061, or PayPal at freakradio.org. Freak Radio Santa Cruz needs your help.
Hey, this is Uncle Dennis here. I want to ask you to support the Anarchist Library. The Sub Rosa hosts Santa Cruz's long-running Anarchist Library, around since the early 1990s, containing thousands of volumes on a variety of subjects, including ecology, history, philosophy, literature, politics, indigenous studies, feminism, psychology, and a small collection of zines. But did you know there are several ways you can support the Anarchist Library? Here are five ways you can help. Submit your review. Sub Rosa is interested in reviews of radical books, zines, and music. If you found something at Sub Rosa that you really liked or didn't, we encourage you to submit a review. You could buy books. There's a list of books we have in the library that they'd like to have, a wish list at a major online bookseller. You could donate books. You're an awesome radical, and you have some awesome books, so many, in fact, that you're ready to donate some of your library to the Anarchist Library. Just drop them off at Sub Rosa. You can donate cash. The Anarchist Library is hosted at Sub Rosa, and so by donating to the space, you are supporting the project. Alternatively, you can donate directly to the library, which occasionally buys new books for the collection. And lastly, check out the books and read them. We love to see the books in circulation, so check out books at Sub Rosa for 2 weeks or more. This is brought to you by the Anarchist Librarians at the Sub Rosa Cafe.
Hi, this is Jello Biafra. If you're tired of propaganda and boring music on the radio, well, there is Free Radio Santa Cruz.
Evening, Santa Cruz. This is Santa Cruz Pirate Schmuck Radio. It's March 28th. I'm in the studio. I've got Star here. You want to tell us your name, special guest?
Let's talk about your radio voice, first of all.
What? First, we have to talk about your radio voice.
Dude, I'm going to be me either way. Can you turn me up in the headphones?
Yes, I can.
That's not how you talk, Heath.
I don't know who that is. Ski Master, the Caveat County Shenanarchist, right here on 101.3.
I don't have to use your name, but it bothers me knowing you personally that you talk like this on the radio. I talk to you so much. You have all these things to say. You're a very interesting person. And you get on the radio, and you have this whole radio affect. Like, you're like some AM radio affect.
And, well, not today. Now coming up is Bathrob Spears Broadsides on Free Radio Santa Cruz. We have a special guest with us today. We'll be getting into her, so to speak, in a moment. She'll be signing in, and maybe, who knows, singing in, perhaps. You never
maybe,
can tell.
Maybe. Could be.
Yes. let's see. Is your mic working? Say something.
Hello.
It's working. Cool.
Okay, good.
Let's have a brief musical break, and then we'll be back. Stay tuned. that was a quickie from Sarah Marlowe. I guess it wasn't that quick, 5 minutes long at least, but it went quick. You're, of course, tuned to Free Radio Santa Cruz at 101.3 FM, and that one was called Not in Our Name. I think I played it before, but hey, you just heard it again. In the studio with me is a guest who actually just called me today, freshly arrived from the north, going to be talking about stuff that's been going on. She's been a street performer here. I don't know much about her other life, but perhaps we'll learn something about it in the next hour. Maybe getting a call from attorney David Beauvais of Berkeley. He is my attorney in the case of the Santa Cruz 11, which has gotten a lot of media play in the last week or two. There's a little bit in this good time, which I actually pointed out to Elizabeth here. That's the name of my guest. Hello, Elizabeth.
Hello, hello.
And he may call in because he's done conspiracy cases before, defended people accused of conspiracy, which I'm accused of, felonious conspiracy, to trespass, to vandalize, to destroy everything that is decent in Santa Cruz. Actually, simply to put a feather in the hat of Bob Lee and a smile back on the face of Police Chief Kevin Vogel. But it's all about the River Street occupation back in November, which I've talked about a lot, and so I'll put that one aside for the moment and talk about you a little bit, Elizabeth, and what's been cooking with you as you sip this. I've never liked that kind
it's
of tea.
It's a mint medley.
Is it really a mint medley, or is it just a pseudo mint medley?
It's more of a pseudo, I think, yeah.
Yeah, it's kind of...
not so great.
Yeah, but, you know, it's hot, and I guess it can lubricate the throat. Mm-hmm. So welcome to back to Santa Cruz.
Thank you.
You were here, what, 4 years ago? Or?
2 years ago.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, it might
okay.
seem like 4 years ago, but
it was
2 years ago.
Yeah, I haven't got really a sense of it. You, last time we ran into each other, you were on the street?
Yeah.
You were singing?
Yeah, I believe I was probably playing the guitar and singing right by New Leaf, I think.
They weren't hassling you for singing near New Leaf?
Not at that point, no. They didn't hassle me.
Good.
Yeah.
Officer Winston didn't come up and tell you to move along, or you were too close to a news rack, perhaps, although it's legal to be right next to a news rack.
Well, I did get hassled sometimes, but that particular time, I don't think I was hassled, no.
Mm-hmm. That's good. Yeah. So you're a singer here, and then you took off for Oregon?
Yeah, I went back to Oregon. Well, I met someone here. We were living on his boat, and in Moss Landing Harbor, and I got pregnant, and so I went back to Oregon, and had the baby in a hospital there in Southern Oregon.
Medford, perhaps?
Close to there. Roseburg, not too far.
Sounds vaguely familiar.
Yeah. And the Child Protective Services came in and took the baby because I had to stay at a domestic violence shelter because I had really nowhere to go. And so they took the baby saying that I was a homeless woman, which...
In Oregon, that's enough condition to take away
a child? I guess there was, you know, there was other things that they said that were untrue, you know. But they did say homeless was, you know, correct in the sense that I was staying in a shelter. But there's a lot of corruption in the CPS in that particular county. And there's a lot of money to be made in foster family care. So what they do is they take these babies, put them in foster family care, and it gives a lot of money to the economy there. It's like the government has a lot of money, you know? So that's one thing they can do to support, to help support the economy.
How long did this whole process take?
It's been about a year. I'm still haven't signed the papers, and I may never sign the papers.
Let's see who's on the line. That could be the very same attorney I mentioned before. Hi there, you're on Free Radio. Can you hear me?
Hello there. This is David calling in. Hey there, David. The infamous David Beauvais of Berkeley, perhaps. Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Okay. Try these.
I think the word is notorious.
Notorious? Well, you say you hate the word notorious, or you find that an apt title?
Oh, I was saying it was an apt title.
Ah, good, good. Well, the more notorious you are, perhaps the more money your progeny will make off your remains. Who knows? I think you have a son. I think I've ever met your son, but welcome to Free Radio.
Welcome.
Yeah.
In the studio with me is Elizabeth. Elizabeth, David. David, Elizabeth.
Hi, David.
Hi, how are you?
Good, how are you?
Good.
So Elizabeth has just been telling us that she's had her child snatched by CPS up in Roseburg, Oregon, a year ago, and she's been fighting it because she was in a women's domestic violence shelter and so termed homeless. There's probably a couple other things you haven't told us that they're accusing you of.
Sure, there are. I mean, I'm bipolar, and that's never been much of an issue, other than,
bipolar, does that mean you go up and buy Frosty products up north?
Yeah, that's exactly what it means. But, yeah, so that's another, another thing that they're accusing me of, which is not illegal, and I take something, and, it's nothing that's been a real problem, but now they're bringing it out so I'm a crazy transient, which is basically what they said on the stand. I'm a crazy transient, which is pretty ridiculous, but they did, and now I'm stuck in this this battle.
And your child is being held in a foster home somewhere. What's her? His name?
Isaiah.
Isaiah. David, how many CPS cases have you dealt with in the past?
Oh, I would say quite a few. I mean, I've dealt with them on two levels. One is representing parents in juvenile dependency proceedings like the one that Elizabeth seems to be describing. And then the other one is bringing affirmative cases for civil rights violations against CPS when they violate constitutional rights, which happens quite frequently.
Yeah, it does. I've done a lot of research since this happened, and I've heard about some really awful things. And it is a civil rights case because ultimately I'm bipolar. I have nothing to hide, and that's a civil rights violation because just because I have a diagnosis that they think they can come in and take the child. And, if there was some record of abuse, I could understand, or even, a criminal record, maybe I could understand, or drugs, but none of those are accurate, And so, for me, it's been really hellish, honestly.
Well, you put your finger on something that's important. The juvenile courts are there to protect children from abuse and neglect, and just because a parent has a diagnosis, doesn't turn them into a bad parent.
Exactly.
Just as a parent might have a criminal record, doesn't turn them into a bad parent.
Yeah, I know.
So what has to be looked at in all of these cases is whether or not that diagnosis contributes to a risk of harm to a child.
Exactly.
And that is something that oftentimes would require expert testimony as well as some facts to show that the child is indeed at risk because of that diagnosis.
Right.
But bipolar is something that can be controlled.
Yeah.
Medication.
Mm-hmm.
And if the parent is on the medication, taking the medication, and no risk to the child.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, I'm no fan of medication myself. Are you thoroughly medicated there?
Well, I do take lithium, which is,
Does that help you?
Yeah, it does. It evens me out. And, I've never been ashamed. I don't think it's anything to be ashamed of. Yeah. So I have mood swings. Everybody does. Mine may be a little more than
I have no mood swings myself.
Right. Right. Right.
Mm-hmm.
But it's just alarming what kind of, what kind of power they have and how I'm caught up in this whole thing. And it's just unbelievable, and I may never get him back. I mean, that's the truth of it. I've had to deal with that reality already. I may never be able to get him back because, my lawyers, my lawyer hasn't really been doing that much.
Court appointed, or did you pay for him?
Well, actually, I got a court appointed attorney who did nothing, and now I have another attorney that I'm paying for, but I'm running out of money. So, yeah, they're doing more than the court appointed attorney, but it's just so much money.
Well, you know, this is an interesting point. At least what I've seen here, the patterns that I've seen with CPS, particularly in the juvenile court arena, is that all of the players, the attorneys for the children, the attorneys for the parents, the attorneys for the county, they have this kind of esprit de corps and this cooperative spirit, which is, it cuts against our normal adversarial system of justice. In fact, in California, there's a statute that says that these courts are not supposed to be adversarial. They're supposed to, you know, be this kind of cooperative, let's work together, and you know, for the good of all, especially the children.
Yeah.
But the reality of it is that the children, that the parents, especially when they have court-appointed lawyers, who are, you know, in there on bunches of cases that have lots of cases to do,
yeah,
possibly treat each case as if you're fighting for your client.
Yeah.
Immediately get the parents to admit petitions and go along with the system and say, if you do it this way, you'll get your children back faster.
Uh-huh.
And a lot of parents who should not be caught up in that system just never get to trial. A juvenile court trial, you know, what they call a jurisdiction hearing here in California, is a rarity.
Mm-hmm.
It is extremely rare. Almost all cases are settled there. And then the parents have to do the case plan, and years go by, and there's a lot of room for people to argue that the parents didn't cooperate with the case plan, or they did something, you know, they shouldn't have done. And it just perpetuates itself to the point where children end up being adopted out.
Mm-hmm.
Well, there's this whole financial incentive to keep children out of the home. And the way that works is that federal dollars go into providing funds for foster care, and they love to make kids have special needs because they get more money if the kid has special needs.
Yeah.
Force the kids into those little pegs.
Uh-huh.
And then if they can adopt them out, they get a bonus.
Yep.
So the whole financial incentives are set to keep the children from coming back home.
Yeah.
So yeah. What was your situation like? Was I interrupting you? Did you want to say something, Elizabeth?
No.
Can you, do you want to go into some of the details of how this happened? Are you comfortable talking about that?
Sure. Well, what happened was, you know, I didn't have the father there because the father had been abusive. So the birth certificate.
Physically abusive?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And so his name wasn't on the birth certificate, and they knew that I had stayed at a shelter, and I didn't have many people there with me. At one point, I was all alone after the birth, which, you know, wasn't good. But and then I had had a little tiff with one of the nurses there who was rude to me, and then I suddenly found child welfare coming into my room, and they talked to me for about 10, maybe 15 minutes, and said they were going to make their decision, and then they called my mom. Which my mom and I have had like a long-standing kind of feud and stuff, and then they came back and took Isaiah. So it was really it really had a lot to do with the fact that they talked to my mother. And
how old was Isaiah when this was happened?
He was about like a day old.
Wow.
Yeah. So it was really it was horrible and
what a time for a child to be with his mother.
Yeah. Definitely.
This is a year ago, yeah?
Yeah, this is a year ago. And
have you seen Isaiah since?
I've seen him. I have visitation with him, yeah, which is nice.
Did they have a warrant?
A warrant?
Yeah.
No.
They didn't have a court order to take him.
No. Well, when they took him, they didn't give me any paperwork. They just took him. And then 2 days later at the trial or at the hearing, they gave me some paperwork, But, I mean, the trial was a joke. The girl got up on the stand who was from CPS, and she said, well, I heard that this woman goes around to Christian churches saying she's a Christian. I heard that she uses the elderly and all of this stuff. Obviously, lies, but, you know, she heard it from somewhere, I guess my mom or somebody. And she said all these things that were clearly gossip. It was just gossip. It was literally gossip that she said on the stand. And then the judge said, you know, ruled for them to take my child. It wasn't like this woman has a criminal history or this woman has abused so-and-so and so-and-so. It wasn't that at all. It was just defaming my character. And then they took my child. So, I mean, there's like, there's no justice there. I mean, all hearsay. It was all hearsay. So.
Did you appeal that?
I didn't even know, like with my public defender, I didn't even know you could appeal it.
Yeah, I get these kinds of things all the time when people come and talk to me about their cases. That they're not told what their legal rights are. They
yep.
don't know they can appeal. They don't know they have avenues they can take. And, you know, it sounds to me like your child was taken without a warrant. That's a violation of the Fourth Amendment for the child. It's a violation of your parental rights.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, because the child wasn't in immediate danger of physical injury.
Yeah.
What the standard is. And so they violated that. So many of my cases are brought on that issue alone. The fact that they came in and took a child that's not in danger. I'm getting ready to file one tomorrow where they came in and took a child at 4 o'clock in the morning and was asleep in his bed and was with mom because the dad had been abusive to the kid and the kid went home with mom.
Whoa.
The worker's blessing. And then for some reason she changed her mind and at 4 o'clock in the morning came with the police and took the kid away.
Wow.
Now, is it...
And that same family was due in family court that very morning where a judge could have fixed all of this.
Uh-huh.
All of this. But instead, they got into this juvenile court dependency stuff.
Wow.
What state was that, David?
That was in California.
Have you ever been up in Oregon, done any cases up there?
No, but I know that there are problems in Oregon.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
The reason I know it is because I have people from Oregon who call me. And there was a case that went to the U.S. Supreme Court last year from Oregon called Camretta versus Green that involved some of these issues as well.
So what kind of resources are out there for moms or dads whose kids are stolen from them or taken from them unlawfully or abruptly or whatever by CPS? And is there an online resource? Is there a particular place they can begin to research this?
There are websites that have stories. FightCPS.com is one. And I know there are others out there. So there are places you can go to read about stuff, but there's not very much by way of support for you in terms of the tangible representation. I think there's about 8 lawyers in California that actually sue CPS. I'm 12.5% of those. And
okay.
The need is far beyond the resources that we have.
So if I wanted to sue or, I mean, I have to have some, I can't have a court-appointed attorney for that, right? Or
no, you would basically hire a civil lawyer who would take it on contingency.
Okay.
And some attorneys will advance costs for clients, some don't, or there'll be some kind of deal where maybe you pay part of the cost or even none of the cost, depending on the lawyer.
Okay.
David, do you have connections with lawyers in Oregon who do sue, are willing to stand up to CPS?
I know one lawyer there, and I don't want to mention that person's name on the air, but if somebody... If Elizabeth would like to know who that person is, she can send me an email.
Okay.
Barbara, you have my email.
Sure. I'll give you the email, Elizabeth.
Tell her who that is. But, yeah, there's not that many lawyers around who do this kind of work. That's too bad, too.
Yeah, it is too bad because this is a real serious problem. It's much more serious than I realized.
Any advocacy groups that either of you know about for people who are in this situation, you know, like client groups who people have gotten together and found, you know, some kind of solidarity and at least sharing stories and sharing resources and that sort of thing?
Yeah, there are some things out there, and you know, occasionally there are demonstrations that are brought, you know, in various places. They'll actually take the streets, and now they're relatively small demonstrations because most people don't realize what a problem this really is.
Uh-huh.
It becomes a problem when it happens to you.
Yeah.
But the public perception, you know, largely is that this is that CPS agencies are there to do good for children. And it's almost this attitude like, how dare you even suggest, along with the way the system is operating.
Right.
And they operate with impunity because the courts are not open to the public. And so you rarely have any kind of journalistic expose. There was actually one in the San Jose Mercury News a few years ago because a reporter was allowed into the juvenile court for a day. She was so appalled by what she saw because it's such a factory operation. It's an assembly line.
Yeah.
So they give you 10 minutes per case.
Yeah.
And there are so many cases that there's nothing good can come out of a system like that.
No.
Well, there's the presiding judge of the Los Angeles Superior Court, named Nash, Michael Nash, is trying to open up the system, and he's made new rules for the L.A. County Court, which basically creates the presumption that these courts will be open, you know, except in extraordinary circumstances. There's some movement to change that, but I think that until these courts can see the light of day, these abuses will continue. But if people can get in and monitor what's going on, like they do with the other courts, then maybe some progress will be made in people understanding what's really going on there.
What about whistleblowers? I mean, you know, we've seen with WikiLeaks and the, you know, the revelation of the murdering from the air American forces, shooting down Iraqis and so forth. Has there been much expose from inside, you know, David?
You know, it's really hard because of the confidentiality laws. Actually, it is a crime to disclose juvenile records without court order. And parents who have tried to, you know, publicly advocate their own cases are often punished for that in the court.
Yeah.
Even to the point of gag orders being issued and that sort of thing.
Wow.
Yeah, so it gets pretty dicey. Most parents are already traumatized by what's gone on with taking in their children, but they don't have the resources or the fortitude to even take on that kind of a challenge. I have had some clients who have done it. I mean, the very first case I ever had, my client was immediately went very public with the situation. And I think ultimately we did prevail in that case, and I think ultimately we prevailed because she did that.
That's good.
Now, they just were so afraid of her that they decided to back down, but it took them about a year and a half before they did.
What was her name?
I can't give you her name.
Even though she went public?
Well, I would rather not mention her name without her permission.
Fair enough.
This happened quite a while ago, and I don't know what her current feeling is about it. If you do legal research, you'll find that there are a number of cases online involving CPS abuses. Most of them are out of the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals in San Francisco, which has the best law in the country on this. And there's quite a few cases, so you get some idea of the kinds of rights that you have that are being abused by the juvenile system. The first right is this warrantless removal of children. The second thing is not allowing parents to have access to their children when they're having medical care. Let's see, what else? Children who are abused in foster care. They've done studies that have shown that children are more at risk in foster care than the homes they're removed from.
Yeah. I've heard that. Yep. And it's true. That's what I've heard. But I have met the parents that are taking care of Isaiah, and that was a good thing. I do believe that they're very genuine and very good. So it's some consolation, but...
Are you trying to get Isaiah back?
Well, you know, I am trying, and I'm also under the impression that my lawyers have said that, you know, it would take a couple years to get him back from this point, still a couple more years to get him back. And it's hard for me to think that at 3 years old he's going to go from this place where he's familiar and then come to me. And so I have to really weigh my options and really think what's best for him. I think to change, you know, places or change parents at 3 years old could really devastate a child. And so I don't know. I'm kind of I'm going back and forth in my head about what to do. This is like the most painful thing I've ever had to.
Well, usually, yeah, you're right. I mean, that is a huge issue. There's this thing known to psychology called reactive attachment disorder.
Uh-huh.
Describes what you're talking about.
Yeah.
That kind of a sudden break in a family relationship.
Yeah.
It can create permanent problems for a child later down the road.
Yeah.
Lack of trust.
Yeah.
And it creates problems in adult relationships.
Uh-huh.
Failed marriages, drug use.
Yeah.
There's a whole litany of things that come out of it. And there's not really any cure, you know, so-called cure for it.
Yeah.
It's a really huge mountain for a person in that position to climb, to have, you know, a relatively happy life.
Yeah.
So my hat is off to you for thinking along those lines, thinking about your child, you know, and what that would be like if at the age of three that child comes back to you. When you've had custody, you know, in his whole life.
I have to put him first.
4 hours.
As hard as it is, I have to put him first. And I know that if I got him back at three, it probably wouldn't be good for his mental health. And so I think that I'm leaning towards...
Especially because he's in a good home, apparently. And I guess the one thing for you is that there'll come a time... Is it a boy or a girl?
It's a boy.
Okay. There'll come a time in his life when he's going to be very curious about you. Well, you visit with him, so he knows you. Okay. I'm just saying that later on, maintain that relationship as much as you can, and things will happen that will bring him back to you. And
you can
have a really good relationship with him. But I think what you're talking about makes a lot of sense. I guess the thing that surprises me about your case is that usually with a very young child like this, they're usually adopted out within a year.
Yeah.
You've been fighting that, though, right?
Yeah, I have been fighting it,
But, you know, David, it sounds like you know, all your cases are based on people who don't want to accept the seizure of their children. So are you suggesting that your advice to every one of these people is give it up, you know, let the kid adjust to their new home and, you know, hope that things will get better later? I mean, is that what you're saying?
Oh, no. I mean, first of all, Elizabeth has a relatively unique situation because this is a child who was taken at birth. Now, most children are not taken at birth. They are taken, you know, much older than that. So... they already have formed an attachment to their parents. And it's a different landscape. But every case is unique, and you have to analyze it uniquely. So, you know, for example, that first case I mentioned where the woman was seriously public, her children were 9 years old when they were taken.
Wow.
Mm.
You know, I have other kids that are 12, 13. So it all depends on these formative years between zero and three or four, where this issue that we're talking about becomes really, really important. And I think Elizabeth is analyzing it in a way that shows her concern for her child exceeds concerned as these other people, that's for sure.
Yeah, as an attorney, have you ever taken a case of someone whose child was taken at the age of, somewhere under the age of two?
Yes, well, I had one case where a child, they put a hospital hold on a child, and then they just released the child a couple of days later. We filed suit on that.
Oh.
So you got in there in time. So
that was
very quick. Were you late calling you up?
Yeah.
Sorry about that.
I'm trying to think, Robert, what other cases I've had where children were that young. I think there must have been some, you know.
Did you give the same advice to them that you sounds like you're giving to Elizabeth?
I'm not giving advice in a legal sense. I'm just
No, this is emotional. This is more emotional advice.
I don't know. I don't really remember that too much.
Okay. I mean, this is a new issue to me, and I'm kind of treating it in an abstract way, so I hope I'm not stepping on too many toes here, though usually I don't really give a shit, but I should, because, you know, but it seems to me, you know, I don't know the answer to these questions. I just, you know, when I hear that people's children are being taken away illegitimately and unnaturally, it sounds like, and also for profit, this is what Elizabeth is saying, what you seem to be suggesting can also be a motivation. I get cranky about the whole thing.
Well, it's something that people should be cranky about.
I'm
cranky about it all the time.
Yeah, I mean, I've been devastated by this, and I don't know what to do. I mean, I guess I can, you know, raise awareness, but I'm not sure what to do with all of this rage and all of this pain, and I have to go forward in a mature way. I mean, I have my music, you know, and that's one way, but it's just, it's unbelievable what they can legally do.
We have a caller. Maybe this would be a question for one or either or both of you. Hi, you're on Free Radio with David, Elizabeth, and Robert. Hey there, can you hear me?
Yes. I was just listening to your show here and your guest, and this is such a really important issue. And
you have children yourself, caller? Or, yeah.
Yes.
Has this happened to you or someone you know?
No, but I was watching a documentary once on a homeless person's child who was taken from her, and it was a very emotional thing to watch. And but I think that your guest, I don't know, deserves some kind of recognition or compensation or
justice would be nice, and reuniting her with her child would be nice too. Even if you could be reunited tomorrow, I guess you'd say yes.
Of
right?
course, yeah, of course. There, yeah.
Any questions for for either my guest or David Beauvais, the lawyer, and who's been working in this field?
Yes, it seems that this is one one issue that really can be solved in the courts, right? I mean, it's really focused on and can be remedied. You know, it's kind of like a state, a bureaucratic issue. Already established, that these kind of situations are going to develop,
You mean in terms of CPS acting inappropriately and the courts somehow being able to correct that situation? Is that what you're suggesting?
Yes, and then the victim being recognized as a victim of something that happened, and then, move on from there.
Let me ask David about that. David, is there any country or state where this is better addressed than California or Oregon?
Not that I know of. It seems like all of the states are pretty much the same on this stuff. I haven't heard of any state that has, some way of doing this that is, better than the way it's done here. Some counties are better than others,
in California, it's not the same everywhere. For example, Santa Clara County is really careful about the warrant requirement.
Because of the publicity of the San Jose Mercury News?
No, I think it's because of lawsuits.
Lawsuits,
that they,
yeah.
That they woke up.
Uh-huh.
I think Alameda County has finally woken up, but I'm not 100% sure of that. But many of the other counties act like this whole body of federal law that requires them to comply with the Fourth Amendment doesn't exist.
Fourth Amendment is the right to be free from unlawful searches and seizures, right?
Correct.
Any other questions, caller?
No questions. Just a comment. A very important issue. You know, I mean, we're like, you know, more of a, you know, curbing the arbitrary use of power against people.
Hear, hear.
Right?
Yeah, I agree with you there.
Yeah.
So, but you know, I mean, we have to recognize that, you know. How are we going to compensate the victims and move on? And
mm-hmm.
you know,
how do we stop it from happening in the first
yeah.
place? Sounds like CPS
yeah.
needs to be reformed or eliminated or replaced or something. That's often been the concern.
Yeah.
I appreciate your call, caller. Thanks for calling in.
Thanks for calling.
All right, thank you. Bye.
What about that, David? And I should ask you also, Elizabeth, are there alternate institutions in other countries than CPS that do a better job of dealing with potential child abuse and problems that juveniles have that aren't addressed by parents?
Well, a lot of the third world countries have no structures at all.
Yeah.
The Western European countries have structures. Not too familiar with them, except I know that in England there's the same kinds of abuses that go on in England that go on here.
Huh.
How about the Scandinavian countries? Know anything about that?
I don't know about the Scandinavian countries.
I expect full research the next time we talk there, Beauvais.
I never even thought about it until you mentioned it.
Well, there you are.
Start researching those countries.
Yeah, maybe you'll find some. They're doing some good stuff over there. Who knows?
You know, he was asking.
They're generally more enlightened than we are anyway.
Yeah, they are. Very much.
The caller
was asking about, you know, can this be righted in the justice system? Can we make this wrong right? You know, I've read there's a whole host of crooked judges along with this whole thing, and crooked therapists who evaluate people and say they're crazy. And there is a whole. So yeah, can it? I don't know if it can all be. CPS has to be reformed, like you said, or eliminated.
Yeah, you've touched on a really important issue. The whole structure is built in such a way that, for example, if therapy is needed,
right.
The parent is ordered to go to the department's selected therapist.
Uh-huh.
Or maybe the parent is given some kind of illusory choice. They get a list of therapists.
Uh-huh.
They're all people that work with CPS.
Uh-huh.
And they get paid by CPS. And they answer to CPS.
Yes, they do. Mm-hmm.
And if they don't come with the recommendation that CPS likes, they're just quietly dropped from the list.
Yeah. Yeah, that's
or
right.
They'll fire them from the case and bring in another therapist who will say the things they want to have said.
Exactly.
That's another reform that would be useful is to that all of the... All of the ancillary services that are provided, the drug program, the batterers program, all of these people should not be getting money from CPS.
Exactly.
And what happened to you, Elizabeth? You said that you're...
Well, I was evaluated by this therapist who, oh my gosh, it was hilarious to me. I mean, not really funny, but just looking at his comments, because, you know, I'm a performance artist, you know, and I'm very... personable, and I like people, and one of the comments he made about me was socially awkward. Like, all these things were so, they're contrived things that he says about people, and all these, that was one of the things I remember, and I just remember thinking, how funny that he would say that, because I'm very sociable, and...
You think it was sort of a script he was
working
from?
Yeah, it was a script that he writes, and says that this person isn't able... you know, dehumanizes them by saying things.
Name of the therapist?
Dr. Eric Morrell.
And did you get complaints about him from other people? Did you talk about other women who had other parents who had lost their kids via this therapist?
I talked to a couple other people who were being evaluated by him and agreed that he was...
Quack, quack?
Yeah. But anyway, so basically, he's hired by them. He gives them the answer that they want, and it is always that this person is crazy or weird.
Have you found that kind of problem in the cases you've been with, David, that the therapists seem to be a little too compliant with CPS, maybe even have a corrupt relationship?
Yes, it's almost invariably.
Uh-huh.
It's nearing 100%.
Yep, yep.
So if I have clients who need to go to one of those people or order to, I usually try to get somebody myself and have them go to the person that we choose for an evaluation anyway.
That's good.
We're talking with Elizabeth and David Beauvais on the issue of a corruption in CPS. What's a mother to do when her child is taken from birth from her, and what can be done to reform the system, if anything? David's a lawyer, has been working on this issue for how many years now?
My first case on this was in 2000.
So you've been practicing for over 25 years, right?
Yeah, I did juvenile dependency before that. I also sat as a pro tem judge in juvenile cases.
Uh huh.
I've had to. Kind of like the experience from the bench as well.
Mm-hmm. So I want, you know, originally I asked you to call in on two subjects, David. One that you had, we'd asked you to talk about before, because you are also my defense lawyer in these felony conspiracy cases that I am and 10 others are charged with in Santa Cruz. And naturally, you're going to reveal your entire strategy here to the prosecution just to kind of give them a little help. They did pretty so poorly the other day in court. Actually, though, I'm interested. I think people are interested. Well, the discussion was going to be around the nature of conspiracy and how it affects political activists. Before I close this kind of topic down, is there anything either of you want to conclude or say with or add on the subject of, you know, what CPS's abuses are, the court's collusion with CPS, so forth?
Well, I think maybe the one thing that I would add to it that kind of aggravates the whole situation is that, especially in the larger counties, judges who work the juvenile bench are generally the newer judges.
Uh-huh.
Because it's not, they don't want to be there. Most judges don't want to deal with this for a couple of reasons. I mean, number one, it's not a career path to the appellate court.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you don't get your name in the paper much. It's kind of lonely, and it's sometimes in a different courthouse away from all the other cases. And so when you're at the bottom of the judicial ladder, you tend to end up in the juvenile court system. Also, a lot of the cases are handled by commissioners or referees, these subordinate judicial officials, because the regular judges, if they can pawn this stuff off to a commissioner or a referee, do so. So it's not, it doesn't have a lot of glamour. Now, having said that, there are also a few judges who are really dedicated to the welfare of children.
That's
and
nice.
They are happy to be there. You know, when I mentioned Judge Nash in Los Angeles, he's one of them.
Good.
And there's a few of them sprinkled around in the court system, but not too many of them.
Yeah.
So it's a backwater, and it's a place where, you know, the judges, I think, because they're not invested in being there for any considerable amount of time, aren't interested in being reformers.
Mm-hmm.
And plus they're new, so they're kind of like haven't maybe even found their judicial voice yet. And so they are more likely to go along with this system, and the commissioners are especially vulnerable because their continued employment is dependent on the judges. It's not dependent on the voters or the appointment of the governor or anything else. So they are much more vulnerable if they were to become mavericks in that system. You know, they're going to find themselves being moved over to handling the traffic cases or something. You know, the speeding tickets.
Well, we're going to be awaiting your next book on the subject, David, since you seem to...
Right.
You know, seriously, I'm not saying, you know, you're going on about it, and I think in ways that are, you know, you raise new issues that I think that are we haven't talked about that need to be discussed. And I imagine some people have already written about it. Maybe this website you mentioned online, which again is...
FightCPS.com.
FightCPS might have some suggestions for people to check out to understand, you know, some of the things you're saying. Though it sounds like some of the thoughts, some of the stuff you're talking about you picked up from your own experience and may not have yet been written about in any collected way.
Yeah, I don't think it has. I mean, not that I know of.
Time for you to start some writing there.
There might be, like, some books that have been written around a particular person's story, and maybe that has happened, but I'm not aware of any, real critiques of the system.
Yeah, and I think this could be an opportunity if you find the time to do it. You're pretty articulate. And not only that, you could make a pretty penny off of this, David, not only because I know you do a number of clients pro bono and you need to supplement your income, you know.
Elizabeth, I wish you the best. I hope that everything works out for you.
Thank you, David. Thank you. I really appreciate it. Thank you for calling in.
And don't hang up because we want to ask you questions we were supposed to ask you a month and a half ago, but for some reason you forgot to call in. Can you imagine? Elizabeth's taking a bathroom break, and I could take a musical break if you want. Do you still feel able to talk? You've been going for 45 minutes, so I don't, you know, I don't know. How are you feeling, David? Are you feeling like you're up for another, I don't know, 15 or 20 minutes worth of conspiracy chat?
Sure, we could have a conspiratorial chat.
Fair enough. Let's form a conspiracy to restore justice in Santa Cruz. Wait, that's what we're doing with this legal defense situation. I guess one question that's on the minds of people who are in this lawsuit, I should say, or in this criminal case, and those who are just watching, is if all these people are found not guilty, do they have any cause potentially to sue, and who should they sue, and what should they sue for?
Well, I think each defendant is probably, you know, at least uniquely situated, or there are groups of defendants that have different, defenses. So it'd be hard to address that question in a broad way. I think you have to look at each situation individually.
I mean, if individuals are taken to court by the district attorney and the police, let's say simply because they were present in a situation, is there any conceivable basis later, and they're found not guilty of the crime of conspiracy to trespass, conspiracy to commit felony vandalism, trespass and felony vandalism, which are the charges that are being leveled against the 11 of us. And I know it's a general question, but really it's sort of a political question, too. Is there generally recourse for folks, or do they just have to sort of take it on the chin and say, this is America, or this is California, or this is Santa Cruz, or this is Bob Lee's district attorney's show? What's the story?
Well, I mean, if you're talking about a false arrest, you can't bring that charge against the district attorney who has filed the charges and had no other connection.
No, but you're suggesting that, yeah, that's one of the kind of the charges I know that has, well, that we've successfully done. You did that, actually, I don't think you were involved in that case. It was the case of Sergeant Lauren Baker when I was falsely arrested, actually 10 years ago, for tabling. I was accused of blocking the sidewalk, which is, of course, false, and I think it was two years later, I think with Kate Wells and the Fossbinders, attorneys from out of town, I got a $5,000 settlement from Baker and also the Santa Cruz Police Department and the individual who signed the citizen arrest form, Matisse Selman of Sushi Now. But it was part of the homeless struggle to keep public space open. He didn't want to do that. He was concerned more about his business, and they were in collusion with the police here in Santa Cruz in front of New Leaf Market. But Is there ever an occasion when the district attorney is vulnerable to a lawsuit, or is he like, you know, some officials completely immune?
Well, it depends on what the function that he's performing is. If he's performing his advocacy function, or he's performing an evaluative function whereby he decides whether he's going to file a criminal charge, that's all protected by what they call absolute immunity, which means you can't sue him for that. Even if he goes into court and lies, his whole case is a tissue of lies. It's very difficult to sue a deputy public defender, a deputy district attorney or the attorney, district attorney himself for that sort of thing.
Go ahead.
The question is going to be in this case, because there were no contemporaneous arrests, who was the arresting officer? And so that's a problem.
And for those who don't understand, what this means is that at the actual 75 River Street vacant bank building leased by Wells Fargo, which hundreds of people trooped through and which was occupied as a attempt to set up a community center, at least in the words of some of the people who occupied it, no one was actually arrested at that time and on that site. They were the police chief was outraged. He negotiated with the occupiers and they peacefully left. There was some vandalism left behind, according to police reports. And the police chief subsequently posted pictures of people on the internet and video asking folks to come forward and identify people who were in the building so that they could be charged with crimes, which then later people were charged with not so much from those identifications as from original videos taken by the police department itself at that time. But these charges came 2.5 months later when several people were handcuffed and arrested at their houses and taken from their homes or taken from their jobs and held in jail on bail. Until they could be either bailed out or until they got to court and they got OR. Some of us were lucky enough to hear about this and went down and said, hold it, we'll turn ourselves in. We had no idea we were committing any kind of crimes. What's going on here? And, of course, of the hundreds of people that went in and out, only a few of those were arrested, even a few of those who the police obviously knew the names of because they were familiar figures in the community. A lot of people were curious about what was going on in that building. Some people were supportive. Some people were just reporters. Some people were advocates. In that situation, if the district attorney then chooses to prosecute later, I guess it was proposed to me by one attorney who heard about this case, David, that there was some argument for trying to disqualify or recuse the district attorney. And I'm not saying that this is necessarily a good strategy, but since the district attorney seems to be, as you say, immune, if he can lie all he wants, he can engage in witch hunts and false charges, and there's no responsibility there other than perhaps the voters can vote him out the next time, which doesn't come up for two more years. Is there any kind of at least slap on the wrist if he gets? Can he be recused? What kind of evidence is necessary to remove him from the case?
Well, that's very difficult, and that's the discussion that we were just having about absolute immunity doesn't apply to that. The absolute immunity applies to action against the district attorney for damages.
Right, but removing him from the case is not damages, it's something else, right?
On recusal, first of all, it's very difficult to get anybody recused. The kind of situation you need, in this particular case, recusal doesn't jump out at me and say, yeah, this is the way to go.
No, I understand, but I'm looking for...
You have to articulate something that represents a bias that is collateral to the prosecution of the defendant himself. I'll give you an example. If a secretary working at the district attorney's office is a victim of a crime, and the district attorney is prosecuting that crime, the district attorney may be subject to recusal because the district attorney has a separate duty to do justice other than just represent what they call the people of the state. has an independent obligation to do justice, and the argument would be that because that secretary is in his office, and the person he knows really well and he has a relationship with, even a power kind of relationship with, that the defendant, the public would not feel confident that the district attorney would do justice in that case.
So it's the appearance of impropriety?
It is both the appearance or the actuality of impropriety.
Mm-hmm.
But appearance is enough.
Now, the reason I raise this issue is I originally kind of asked you to speak on the issue of conspiracy more broadly and how it becomes a political tool in the hands of some politicians and district attorneys historically, and I think particularly in this case here as well. I want to move into that area too, to talk about that and the nature of a conspiracy charge, which usually an ordinary person hearing the word conspiracy would think that's sort of people in the secret room say, we're going to go out and shoot this guy, or we're going to go out and plant and rob this bank, and then they go out and they do it. And so they're not only robbing the bank, but I suppose there's a conspiracy to rob the bank, which is important if, let's say, there's a person who's a part of this conspiracy who doesn't actually show up at the bank, but they want to charge him with something. They arrest everybody at the bank, and there's a third person who is part of that conspiracy. He was in the room. Maybe he was the driver guy who got away, or whatever. That's what I think most people think about as a conspiracy. So they think, well, in order to be convicted of a conspiracy, you have to plot with somebody, and you have to engage in some criminal behavior. Yet, we have two individuals who, reporters, Alex DeRosi and Bradley Stewart, who were taken before a judge for a preliminary hearing last month, and the only, quote, evidence against them was not that they had conspired to do anything, but that they were present reporting and at points were inside the building. There was no evidence that they trespassed in the sense that, the technical sense, that they were asked to leave and refused to leave, but simply that they were there. And the judge felt that that was enough evidence to... he dropped the felony vandalism conspiracy, which I think we could talk about too, because people can be convicted of vandalism and conspiracy to vandalize even if they touched nothing, because somebody else did it and they're part of this group, therefore they're responsible for what other people who they may not even know about or may have done it at another time, unconnected with them, did it. And therefore, I mean, I'm trying to kind of get across that what seems to be happening here, as I understand it, is not conspiracy in the sense that ordinary people understand it, but a legal sense of the law, which makes people very vulnerable to significant prison terms. It's up to 3 years in jail for this crime. Do you know the penalty for this particular conspiracy to commit felony vandalism and the conspiracy to trespass, which is the crimes that are charged against all we're charged against all 11 of us and are still charged against 7 of us?
Yeah, it's 3 years, right?
That's what I thought it was. And the trespass is 6 months. So each of us faces a total of 2 trespass charges and 2 felony conspiracy charges, which amount to, actually, there's a felony conspiracy, and then there's a felony vandalism charge, which I assume amount to a total of 7 years total if you add all those charges together. Those are pretty serious charges, but they essentially involve...
Well, I don't want to go into California sentencing calculations, but it doesn't actually pencil out to 7 years.
But somewhere around there? Or?
A lot of time. I mean, it's more than seems... to serve justice in this kind of case, and I doubt that any of the defendants would actually go to state prison on this case. It really is a state prison case.
Hmm. But there would still be jail terms and the threat of that hanging over their heads, right?
Right, there would be, and it's no small matter to have a felony on your record, although in this particular instance, at least the conspiracy to commit trespass could be reduced to a misdemeanor at some point along the road, because there is a misdemeanor conspiracy possibility here with these charges.
But again, you know, we're talking, this is sort of the legal thicket, the tangle of the law. For ordinary people, the whole purpose of laws is to protect the community from real crimes. So you have a crime of murder, you have a crime of theft, you have a crime of conspiracy, where that... But here, in this case, conspiracy doesn't seem to mean what ordinary people thinks it means. Can you clarify that for us? Am I accurately describing a distinction here?
Well, conspiracy is kind of elusive, and that's one of the problems with conspiracy law is that it's not limited in any way in California. For example, in Britain, their conspiracy law is very limited. It involves crimes of public morality, and I think there's one, financial crimes can be subject to conspiracy law. In the United States, you can take conspiracy and hook it up with just about anything. But this is one of the most crazy conspiracy theories that I've ever seen presented in a court.
Well, let me be devil's advocate here. Why do you think it's crazy when a bunch of people are, you know, apparently went into a building without the permission of the owner, supposedly? They stayed there for 3 days, supposedly, without even though police asked them to leave. And then when they left, there was property damage behind. Aren't they guilty of a conspiracy to come into the building? And shouldn't they be punished and brought to justice? And isn't that conspiracy law a good way to do that?
No, I think trespass law would work just as well. And I also think that vandalism statute would apply. You don't need to have a conspiracy. I mean, conspiracy is often used to bring people into the net who were not direct participants in the activity itself. And it's also a way of attributing the conduct of one person to another, even though that other person didn't do that specific act. So that's the way, I mean, conspiracy law works in general. But you still have to have a meeting of the mind to commit the unlawful act. And you have to have an overt act in furtherance of that, although that overt act could be something less than an attempt to commit the crime. And upon the unlawful agreement coupled with a single overt act, which can be totally innocuous, you've got a completed crime right there, even if nobody ever stepped into the bank.
But I'm trying to cut through the legal language, which is a little hard for me to...
Okay. What I'm trying to say is that just because people are involved in an activity doesn't mean that there is a conspiracy among those people.
So a political protest, which I think everyone, prosecution and defense, both acknowledges this is a large protest walking to various banks to raise community awareness that we have a number of criminal banks in this country and in this community who are engaging in huge regular crimes and ripoffs and being rewarded by the government for what they do. Wells Fargo was, I think, the ultimate focus in this particular protest.
Well, it's just like everything else in this society. The bigger the heist, the more immunity you have to prosecution. Every once in a while, they'll, you know, nail somebody's hide to the wall like they did with Madoff, you know, and say, oh, look, our system operates evenly. Even the big players, the ones who do really evil stuff and steal people's money, you know, we sometimes go after them, but it has nowhere the consistency that going after welfare fraud has, for instance.
Sure, and there's a lot of.
You've got to get that mother, you know, who's making that extra $200 a month.
Yeah, you got to be. Yeah, right, yeah.
Now,
go ahead.
It's the same with this. It's like the 99%, there's a different system of justice for the 99 than there is for the one. And you're seeing that in operation in this case. That's exactly what this case is.
And it's not just that...
Fargo is engaged in the most outrageous conduct, and there aren't even civil charges, much less criminal charges, against them being brought by the government.
No, I think Wells Fargo recently had a settlement which Kamala Harris, the Attorney General of California, resisted for a while. But essentially, it allows the large banks that stole people's homes for hundreds of thousands of dollars in these foreclosure frauds and these phony derivative bundles and so forth in this bubble that happened 4 years ago are required to pay, what, $2,000 per victim now, some such thing?
Yeah. But who's gone to jail? What Wells Fargo executive has gone to jail?
No, instead you...
Bank of America has gone to jail.
Exactly.
Where's the death penalty for corporations that do this kind of stuff?
Indeed. And I think that's been the purpose and is a continuing purpose. Even a protest had happened against Wells Fargo and Bank of America yesterday and the day before in San Francisco, where people, they occupied... I guess they went into a Wells Fargo shareholders meeting day before yesterday.
Right, they own shares too, some of them.
And they own shares, and
they brought their shares with them and couldn't get into the meeting.
Right, but you know their number of them were arrested for trespass. I imagine. I'm not sure it was for trespass, but if they were arrested for trespass under the theory that DA Bob Lee and Rebecca Young have down here, she's the prosecutor who's directly involved in this case. They would also be, would they not be? Could be charged for conspiracy to engage in trespass.
I don't know, because I don't know exactly how all that came down. I do know it was planned. I'm not sure the break-in at 75 River Street, if you want to call it that, was planned.
And there isn't, the word break-in is probably not accurate, because there's no indication anything was broken into. There was apparently, according to...
Well, I read somewhere, and I don't know the truth of this, but there was a lockbox and a key in it.
There was a lockbox with a key that somehow people got, as I understand it, from the police reports, and the place was opened up. Now, once it was open, and there were police standing by, and people were streaming in and out, and police were watching placidly. Is that a break-in? I would find it an unusual usage. I suppose maybe the police were deeply intimidated with their guns and tear gas and batons, and you know, the force of law behind them. But it's hard for me to see that, and that's what. You know, what really amazes me, Bob Lee put these videos online that shows people coming and going, police officers sort of standing by, watching, chatting with some of the demonstrators and so forth. It's just, it's a surreal scene.
Yeah, it is, actually. It's very unusual. And I know that they're going to say that the crowd was too big, they didn't have the manpower to actually shut it down right then and there. But it also seems clear that they were not particularly vigilant in warning people not to go in, or I don't know if they ever went in themselves and told people to leave.
Yeah, I don't know if there's any indication. There's some indication that Sergeant Harms went to the door, according to the police testimony, at some point and made a relatively quiet announcement that at least other testimony said that few people could hear, and... You know, so there may have been some warning given to some people. But again, getting back to this conspiracy issue, is this something that's been used in other political cases you've been involved with that has been done essentially to heighten the up the ante, so to speak, and encourage people to take what they invariably do? We were talking earlier about CPS cases. I think it's generally true in criminal cases that 95% of criminal cases are plea bargained out.
Or they terminate before trial. A lot of times there are dismissals.
And there are dismissals. We had this amazing dismissal yesterday, which I thought was, of course, I think it was due to a lot of incompetence by District Attorney Rebecca Young in this situation where four defendants were told that, you know, they supposedly got all these conspiracy to trespass, conspiracy to create felonies. But there was no evidence that they trespassed in the first place. There was no evidence that they vandalized. So the judge kind of threw up his hands and said, you know, I'd really like to help you. He didn't say it in those words, but that seemed to be his attitude to Rebecca Young. But, you know, what can we do? These elements of the crime are not going to be provable, and therefore we can't really forward this case to trial, of course, at which point Rebecca Young immediately then said, okay, we're going to refile anyway. Now, let me ask you about that. If at a preliminary hearing charges are thrown out and the cases are refiled, they can go straight to trial anyway, right?
Well, there's two ways the DA can go with that. The DA can refile and get a new preliminary hearing. And the you know, and then the case would proceed that way, or the DA could file an information, which is the charging document that follows the preliminary hearing. And if that happens, then the defense would bring what's called a 995 motion challenging the information and asking that it be set aside. And to the extent that the magistrate who heard the case at the preliminary hearing decided credibility issues, those credibility determinations the people are going to be stuck with. The district attorney will be stuck with those. And so it's going to come down to questions of law, whether there was enough evidence to constitute a crime.
So let's look at this, because both these things are happening in this set of cases. In the one situation with Alex DeRosi and Bradley Stewart, the two journalists who were given a preliminary hearing in March, and who they had the felony vandalism and the conspiracy to commit felony vandalism charge dismissed by Judge Silman, who heard that case, but the other conspiracy charge, conspiracy to trespass, and the two trespass charges were not. They're going to be going directly to trial on May 20th. Although they have, I understand, I'm told by one of their attorney's assistants, filed what you say is a 995 motion to dismiss those charges. So in this case, the district attorney, Rebecca Young, went forward and tried to proceed by information to take the case pretty much directly to trial. What would the charges go to trial? Would there be any hearing short of the trial where that would be stopped by Judge Silman or some other judge? It wouldn't be tried by Silman. I think it's going to be tried by Judge Burdick.
Yeah, it'll be a different judge. I mean, if the 995 is granted, then the case gets dismissed.
But now, so there's a hearing that's coming up for these two individuals in this 995 motion, or it's done in camera behind closed doors?
No, it's open court.
So that actually is probably the next event coming up. For those who are following this case, there will be, I presume, a 995 hearing to determine whether at least the charge, is it all charges or just the charges that were dismissed and then refiled by the district attorney?
Well, the 995 would attack, well, it could attack any of the charges that were before the magistrate. Judge, I'm going to call it. It's a little confusing now because we used to have municipal courts, and preliminary hearings were municipal courts. Now it's a unitary court system. So I'm going to call the judge who heard the preliminary hearing the magistrate, because they still use that term, even though he's a regular judge just like all the others.
Mm-hmm.
The 995 could challenge all of the charges, or it could just challenge the charges that were filed after the magistrate decided to dismiss those charges.
And there will be a hearing before another judge who to determine whether that 995 motion, which will either challenge the charges that were dismissed and then refiled, or all the charges should be dismissed.
Right.
And what kind of arguments and evidence are involved in that hearing?
Well, it basically comes down to whether or not there was sufficient evidence at the preliminary, and there's different ways in which you can challenge and information. But what seems relevant here is lack of sufficient evidence to justify the charges. So it becomes a question whether or not the prosecution sustained their burdens of proof, probable cause, as to the charges that were found.
And the only evidence that they can use is evidence that was presented at the preliminary hearing, or can the prosecution bring in new evidence?
No, it's limited to the preliminary hearing.
So what Rebecca Young apparently has told us she's going to do in the case of the four people who were discharged yesterday of all charges by Judge Burdick, declared to be free and innocent, and or at least the charges are gone. I guess they're innocent, I mean, at the moment. What Rebecca Young is saying is she is going to refile against two of them, maybe against all four of them, the same charges, and she will then seek a new preliminary hearing where she can bring up new information to support the charges. That's the other road that can be followed, right?
Yeah, there's two roads, and one of them is to just refile the complaint.
Now, is this a costly approach for the district attorney? I mean, what, is this something? I mean, it certainly costs the defense and defense lawyers, and as I think a lot of time and wear on defendants, and defendants are losing their jobs, and some of them are facing health problems. Some of them are being evicted. One of them has, you know, had a serious mental. The person has attempted suicide. We've had all kinds of consequences that happen to this. But what about the cost to the community in terms of just simple financial costs? Is this hours spent? Do you have any sense of how much this costs for 11? If you have 11 defendants,
it's got to be enormous. I mean, devoting all these resources to this, it's a political question of whether there's any benefit to the community in using taxpayer dollars for this. And that's a political question.
I mean, what you have, I mean, for the community, anybody listening, it's, I'm talking to the converted here, but you have a bank that has been vacant now for 4 years. Previously it was the Coast Commercial Bank, then it was leased by Wells Fargo, but never used, perhaps because they own the bank across the street and they don't want competition, or who knows what. But it's now surrounded by a barbed wire fence, and it has not been... who knows? There may be people sleeping in the bank now, for all we know. There are actually two or three banks, at least, that are vacant now in Santa Cruz as the economy continues to deteriorate. And people outside are homeless, have no place to go, and people find vacant buildings to sleep in. I guess the difference in this occupation was people were quite upfront about it, wanted to negotiate with Wells Fargo, according to stories I've been that I've read in the Good Times and police reports about what was said by the activists. I'm being careful in what I'm saying, and I apologize to listeners for this, because on my attorney's advice, I should try to avoid incriminating statements. Is that true, David Beauvais?
Well, I would go beyond that. You probably should avoid any statements, whether they're incriminating or not.
And that
has to do with your role in any of this.
Right. I mean, so... If I've said in the past I walked into the building, that would be the kind of statement the district attorney would eat for lunch.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's obviously not in your interest.
Even though, but my problem, of course, is I have a countervailing interest, which is to put out truth to the community, which is always a difficult matter, I guess, for attorneys who are dealing with political activists and trying to defend them. You've had this problem before, probably with other clients. You've been defending People's Park advocates 2 decades ago, and...
Well, they are a little different, you know. I mean, the standard advice you're going to get from a lawyer is keep your mouth shut.
Right.
But it's up to the client to choose to follow that or not follow it, because they have to live their own life and deal with the consequences of it.
And another issue for defendants in this case has been attorneys urging them not to meet with each other for fear this will be used as proof of conspiracy. Kind of after-the-fact conspiracy. So every single client has been told by their lawyer, I don't think you told me this, but then you weren't my lawyer initially, and I don't know if my previous lawyer, Nicole Lambros, told me this or not. I think she might have. Don't meet with other people who are part of this. Don't be a part of a defendant support meeting. Stay away from other defendants and so forth. Don't talk about your case to anyone.
I agree with that as you posed it. It's probably not wise for the defendants to huddle together. I wouldn't say that their doing so was in furtherance of any kind of a conspiracy. The conspiracy relates to the occupation of the bank, and that's over. So this is all after the fact. It's not within the facts of the so-called crimes themselves.
So the reason that you would advise them to not to get together with each other wouldn't be because they can be charged with either new crimes, or because this could be used as evidence to further the claim that they're part of a general conspiracy around the bank.
So the reason that you don't want to do this is because there is no legal privilege among the defendants.
No confidentiality, you mean?
Right. Now, if they are in a group meeting with a lawyer or lawyers, that's different, because that would be protected.
And yet...
But also, you got to make sure that that group is composed of only the client and the lawyers, not other people, except perhaps investigators or people, ancillary staff of the lawyers could be there. You could have interpreters there, you know, that sort of thing. But,
and of course, the problem is that this works directly against any kind of meaningful meeting and organizational work by defendants if they want to meet together, because, first of all, they can't persuade public defenders to take any time out even to talk to them between hearings, much less to talk to them in you know, solidarity political meetings that would help people to help raise community awareness of the abusiveness of these charges and urge the DA to drop them. So they can't really get lawyers into these meetings. And if they could get one lawyer in, there would be the problem that other clients are not supposed to talk to the lawyers of other clients, right?
Without the permission of the lawyer.
Right, and the lawyer has said, don't talk to anybody. They're not going to get the permission of the lawyer. And this brings me to another issue, which is important,
but
I think.
Then you've got to be careful about what the agenda is.
And what's,
well,
whose agenda? What are you talking about?
The agenda of the meeting. Let's say that all of the attendants got together and had a meeting.
Right, which we have.
What is said at that meeting, you know, could possibly be inquired into by the DA, but probably only in a situation in which one or more of those defendants took the witness stand.
Say that again. One or more of the defendants did what?
Witness stand.
Took the witness stand.
Yeah. In other words, if you're in that meeting and you take the stand, the DA can ask you about that meeting. Who was there? What was said?
Right. And if you say something like, we talked about a common defense because of the abusiveness of these charges, that somehow could nonetheless be used by a clever DA to reflect badly on the defendants?
Well, possibly. I mean, because it raises this kind of inference of collusion, and it sounds ugly. But I was thinking more along the lines of Defendant A takes the witness stand, and the DA says, what did Defendant B say at the meeting about what he did when he was in at 75 River Street? What did Defendant C say about it, you know? Didn't Defendant D say X, you know? And there could be a whole line of questions exploring the subject matter of that meeting. And that's why it's not a good idea.
At least it's not a good idea to talk about what specifically happened on the days in question.
Yeah.
Not because what happened in the days in question is a real crime, but because it is being considered to be a crime by the district attorney and being used to criminalize, I think this is the whole point, to criminalize the Occupy Santa Cruz movement and to criminalize activists generally and to chill them from supporting each other and even considering the kinds of peaceful protests that in the past have included occupations. I think you and I got together. Our first legal get-together was an occupation of a thing called the Heiner House in 1992. Do you remember that?
Yes.
And, you know, as an attorney, you might advise me not to talk about that, right? Because it would alert the district attorney to claim that I have a criminal history of occupation. Might that be true?
I don't know. I'd rather not get into that discussion right now.
Right. And I mean, I think you're proving my point, right?
Right.
So this is a dutiful...
I just want to say one thing that, you know, you had mentioned, like, is this unprecedented where they would do this? And I guess the closest thing I can remember to it in history would be the Chicago conspiracy trial.
Of 1968.
Right.
Actually, 69. 68 was the Chicago conspiracy police riot at the Democratic Convention there, in which they were beating people up. And then they charged eight people, the Chicago Eight, one of whom was gagged and separated, Bobby Seale, and they had instead the Chicago Seven, which is kind of the more famous white guy trial.
Right. That's what I was talking about.
Right. That's a...
That's where Abby, I think it was Abby Hoffman...
Jerry Rubin. Yeah.
We couldn't even agree on lunch. So, you know, I mean, I don't know what facts the DA thinks she has to show that there was any kind of planning of this. Now, it's possible to prove conspiracy by the conduct of the defendants, even if you can't prove that they got together at such and such a place and penciled out how they were going to make this happen.
Which seems to be, and this is the point I brought up originally when I started talking to you about this, this is the difference between a common understanding of what conspiracy means and the actual kind of punitive use of this charge in our case. Because I've been to two preliminary hearings now. I've seen the evidence that the district attorney has provided to at least to us so far. And it is essentially, there is no evidence whatsoever of any collusion between any of the defendants of any kind, even either at the meeting, at the building in question, the vacant bank, before the vacant bank, or immediately after the vacant bank. So it has to be simply, you're saying, some kind of, they were all there, and that indicates somehow a conspiracy.
That would be with the DA's argument, but I don't think it's a very good argument.
Neither did Judge Burdick, by the way. Yes,
and I think what you have to show, if you're going to try to show a conspiracy by conduct, you're going to have to show that there was a design that was carried out. Now, you're going to have to show, for example, let's say it's a bank robbery. You know, if people go in there like they know what they're doing because they planned it and they position themselves in certain strategic ways, or one person was going around smashing the surveillance cameras, another one was by the door, and a third one was hopping over the counter to get to the money trays, and a fourth one was with a gun going into the vault, and they all just acted out that kind of a scenario.
What about somebody in a bath?
Let me finish.
Yeah, go ahead. I'm sorry.
That would imply planning, because
right.
You don't go in there and get that result without planning.
Right.
It's intelligent design of a bank robbery.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that's not what happened here. Just because a bunch of people went through a door is not the kind of distinctive act which shows that they got together and decided to do this.
Hmm. How about somebody in a bathrobe with a tape recorder interviewing people?
Well, that person is suspect right from the gate.
Of course, of course. Yeah, obviously some kind of, we might want to call CPS and have him take, except he's probably a little too old for that.
At least take the teddy bear into custody.
That's been done. The teddy bear was banned from the courtroom on at least on two occasions. So. That's Eduardo, the police bear, who had to wait outside. Actually, what I'm referring to, for those who don't know, is I appeared in two courtrooms with a bathrobe and teddy bear for arraignments and actually for other court appearances in solidarity with people who have to face the sleeping ban laws in Santa Cruz. And indeed, the occupation of this building, I was told, in part had to do with the fact that there's a large homeless population in Santa Cruz who have no place to go for the winter. 95% of the people are outside with no legal shelter. You have twice as a significantly greater death rate than for ordinary people, and the assault rate is four times as much, and the people die 20 years younger. So there's been a big issue about homeless vulnerability, and that's why, and what the response of the city is to talk nice about it and then to criminalize people for necessary behavior in public spaces like sleeping. So, hence my bathrobe and teddy bear, and the bailiff didn't like my teddy bear and insisted that the bear remain outside. And, of course, he did. So, we're talking with David Beauvais, attorney at law, who has generally been a pro bono representer of a lot of people, though you are actually a professional attorney who make your livelihood by representing people, right, in cases.
In a variety of cases, yeah.
In a variety. But you've also done a lot of work where hundreds of hours, maybe more than that, representing people who haven't paid you a dime.
I've done some pro bono. I think all lawyers should do pro bono.
Uh-huh. I know that you've had some bad experiences with the Santa Cruz courts here in cases where you did take on a case or two pro bono with me, one of which is the the case of the metro sign blocking crime. You may remember that particular case.
Sure.
Yeah. What's your? You've read over a bit of the description of Judge Burdick's dismissal of the case against four defendants. What significance does that have for the other seven in your mind? Does it have any much significance, or is it simply the other are going before another judge who actually forwarded charges from the two other defendants who are going to trial on May 20th, Alex DeRosi and Bradley Stewart?
Is that the Judge Stillman you referred to?
That's correct.
Okay.
Yeah, Stillman will be hearing our preliminary hearing on May 29th. And he had previously said, I heard all this evidence, I won't go for the felony vandalism stuff, but you guys are, we're sending felony trespass charges forward to trial for at least those two. And then we have Judge Burdick's decision yesterday, which dismissed all charges against four defendants, saying that there is no evidence of vandalism, no evidence of trespass, or at least insufficient to prove trespass. And, you can't cook up a conspiracy out of thin air, so... I'm not quoting him exactly. What's the significance of Judge Burdick's decision yesterday, if anything, in your view?
Well, I mean, it doesn't have any binding effect on another judge who hears other defendant cases.
Uh-huh. Does it encourage you in any way?
Well, I don't know. I haven't really thought about that too much, whether it's encouraging or not.
Yeah,
go ahead. Obviously, you do have, the specter of a judge having already heard a lot of the same facts. And although the preliminary hearing findings are tailored to the particular defendants involved, if he's expressed an opinion on the general subject matter, it seems like the defendant facing him in a second prelim is probably going to
get the same treatment.
Going to get the same treatment because the judge doesn't want to be inconsistent with himself.
And judges in these cases can't be disqualified unless you can show cause, right? You don't have a peremptory challenge against judge. Those of us who are in that going before Stillman don't have a preliminary challenge against him, a preemptive challenge. We have to show he's somehow biased, which is not likely to be shown, right?
Well, there is, of course, there's this provision that called a 170.6 where you can challenge without showing any cause. You can only use that once. And it only can be used once in any case.
But it was used originally to disqualify Simons by another one of the defendants, and that used it up for all of us, didn't it?
I think that's the law. I'm pretty sure that it is. I'd have to actually look at it, but I think.
So I'd like to apologize to listeners. I'm talking with Attorney David Beauvais of Berkeley, and I was going to make it and we have talked a bit about conspiracy law more broadly. But it has also gone back a lot to the actual case that 11 of us, now 7, and hopefully it'll stay 7, but I think it'll be at least 9, are wrapped up in, I think, essentially a matter of the vanity of the police chief and the district attorney's office here. I'm still not clear of the motivations of this case, and I'm hoping to understand more of it. Well, David, I appreciate your coming on the air. Do you have any other thoughts you want to share with us on this issue? Are you
nothing that comes to mind.
Okay. Well, then I'll just let you go.
All right. Well, you have a good evening.
You too, and thanks for taking an extra half hour. You've been going now for an hour and a half, so I appreciate your coming on the air.
Okay, I'll send you my bill.
And if you already have actually. But if there are any vacant banks up there that need occupying, you probably need to talk to other people at this point.
Okay.
All right.
All right. Well, take care.
Yeah, you too. And it's actually an interesting issue for me because I'm always under pressure to say absolutely nothing about public issues like occupying banks and vacant buildings. But I tend to agree with what Becky Johnson put out as a sticker that a lot of us were wearing in and around the court, which is vacant buildings are the crime. They are the crime, actually. And that's really the issue here, at least one of the issues involved in this case. And
Maybe it's apprehension by authorities that their vacant buildings are all in jeopardy, although I don't see a lot of people rushing to do occupy vacant buildings, and it's not something that, you know, I think that any of the defendants were really much involved in planning to do, or, you know, things simply happen in the course of events which, you know, I as a reporter, for example, report on. I certainly am sympathetic to people engaging in trying to expand public space for poor people and trying to hold banks accountable, no question about it. Did I plan such a thing? No. You know, I mean, didn't even know it was going to happen. But like many, many people, I went in to see what was going on. So, you're tuned to Free Radio 101.3 FM, Santa Cruz, California is the place I'm talking from. Coming up soon, in about 20 minutes, we're going to have Uncle Dennis doing From the Cream to the Dregs. You're going to get the cream, and if you go to the courts and check out the district attorney's office, I guess you may find some of the dregs. I suppose I'm sort of feel a little sour grapes about this, I got to tell you. I don't like what's going on, and it bugs me. Anyway, in the last program, and I do a twice a week set of programs, on Sunday I'll be coming back with another program as well at 9:30 in the morning. I was going through interviews I did with people at the Project Homeless Connect that happened a week ago Tuesday, and I'm going to play some more of those interviews. Some of them aren't even interviews. They're attempts to interview. The next thing you're about to hear is Homeless Lack of Services Center Director Monica Martinez, who has been lying about stuff around the rights of homeless people in terms of, well, what her Homeless Lack of Services Center does if somebody comes and says, they gave me a camping ticket or a ticket for sleeping outside. Will you give me a letter that indicates that your shelter was full, if it was that night? And the answer is no, they don't do that. But her public answer is yes, they do that. So it's an interesting contradiction, and I ran into her, wanted to hold her accountable for that. But she first she told me, I'd heard some sort of confusing information that she might have changed, the real policy might have changed. Unfortunately, on reviewing the interview with the person, I found that really wasn't the case, that he didn't really get the letter, and he didn't get any evidence. If you get on a waiting list at the Homeless Lack of Services Center, they're not supposed to give you a camping ticket. That's a new city law that somehow makes the Homeless Lack of Services Center the gatekeeper for civil rights for homeless people. If you join their racket, you get civil rights. If you don't, you don't get civil rights, which, of course, seems to me highly unconstitutional. But let's consider the positive aspect, which is, well, here's one way, you know, join with the Homeless Lack of Services Center, get on their waiting list, and supposedly they'll dismiss your tickets. Why doesn't she then give people a little statement that I'm on the waiting list so they can show that to the police? She lies about it, says she does, but nobody ever gets them. And so I wanted to approach her and ask her about that, and I did. And here's some of what happened when I did. It's not very exciting, but it's what actually went down.
Now, we spoke earlier, and you helped to clarify something that has been worrying me for a year and a half. And that has to do with, what can a person do who gets a camping ticket, who, let's say, isn't on your homeless service center waiting list?
So, Robert, I have a job to do here, and I would rather not talk into your recorder. So.
Just briefly, very quickly?
No, sorry. I'm volunteering today, and I don't want to talk into your recorder.
You may be accused of stonewalling me again. There you have it.
We have a caller. Hi there, you're on Free Radio.
Hi, Uncle Robert. You know, I happen to know for a fact that there's a homeless person, Anonymous, was surprised to be homeless, found himself homeless, an Anonymous Junior who they camped together and ran together, who were suddenly, because they kept a doctor's appointment, were evicted from the loft, but they were on the list for the shelter, and But they didn't know what to do that night, and it was pretty scary. And they slept three nights in a row at the City Hall parking lot. Got up early before anybody noticed, and no problem. But one night, this officer came along, gave us tickets. So we went around and did what, like everybody says, to go get it removed because we're on the list and everything. But every bureaucrat points to every other bureaucrat, and it doesn't get done. And then you go to warrant, and you don't have. It's just all over with once you go to warrant.
So let me.
It's a lie. It's not true at all. There is no safety valve. There's no safety net.
Let me understand this, David. When did you sleep, or when did these people sleep at City Hall? I'm not sure if it was you or your friends, whoever it was, but when did this illegal sleeping outside happen?
It was the end of September.
And
they just got out of the loft by surprise because when they called to say that they had a doctor's appointment, they would make them 15 minutes late, they told them not to worry about it, to come in the next night. So they came in the next night and said, oh, you didn't show up, so you're out of the program. Said, but you said for us to not show up. So it's like, you know, all nobody, everybody blames everybody else for, like, having different rules.
There was not only, you know, you what you're saying is that there was an exclusionary action by the Homeless Lack of Services Center's Pauli Loft program that kind of predated this, that put you and your colleagues out, if it was you and your colleagues. But then you got ticketed because you slept at City Hall?
Well, we got ourselves on the waiting list first, and we kept checking, you know, those first three, four, five nights. You know, we were, like, trying to find out where's the best place. We'd be driven up by the edge of the Poganip, and you know, we didn't like being so much out in the country. And we were, like, fun time. We were taking care of business, you know, medical or something. We were both disabled, and we found ourselves in town, and we found that right there around City Hall was real quiet, and, you know, we could just duck down, and we were safe, and we felt safe, and we fell asleep, and we slept well. And I always wake up at pre-dawn, so we did that, and we got a ticket. But
how many times were you ticketed?
Once.
And so when you got tickets, you said that and those tickets are supposed to, of course, be automatically dismissed. You were on the waiting list at the time, right?
Yeah.
And did you ever get a warrant, or did you ever get a failure to pay notice in the mail indicating that the ticket had not been dismissed?
I don't know that I had. They probably took my Bakersfield address off my driver's license or my senior ID. You know,
if you check with the court in town, you can find out. I could check too, because I think I know your name, caller.
Oh no!
I know who you are. Oh no!
The place is surrounded by sheriffs now.
Yes, your history, buddy.
Everybody that believes in liberty.
We know you're trying
to
occupy the area.
Good luck,
okay.
Uncle Robert. I'm telling you, these are pretty shaky times. As you know, we're in transition between two houses right now, and it's going to be pretty rough, but we know we got friends like you that just paved the way and opened up new doors for us all.
I wish that were true.
All wish that were true. I try to help in my own humorous little way.
And you do. You have been helping for years, David.
Okay. Thanks, Uncle Robert. Talk to you soon.
Take care. It's David Silva, former city council candidate, activist for the rights of HIV persons, and a guy who's been a homeless advocate when he was, particularly in the 90s here. Now he's been struggling a lot with personal circumstances, and you've heard him call in on the show if you're a regular listener. You're tuned to Free Radio at 101.3 FM. I'm Robert Norris. The name of the show is Bathrobes, Piers, Broadsides. Been talking a lot about the 75 River Street prosecutions, which, as I said, took a turn, seemed to be a turn for the better yesterday in Judge Burdick's Department 6 court. Which you can read about in a really great article by Becky Johnson on her website, or you can go directly to her website. Is Becky Johnson One Woman Talking .blogspot.com. But if you go for Becky Johnson One Woman Talking, you'll find her website, which she's been covering homeless civil rights issues for a couple of decades now on that website for a couple of years for sure. You can also go to the developing website for the Santa Cruz 11, which is santacruz11.org. I believe it's santacruz11.org. I'm never sure if it's .org or .com, but I think that's the case. Let me double-check on that just to be sure. And her story is she really covers the hearing at which apparently it was a very rare finding for, I was told by a couple of people that judges don't, they sometimes throw out a few charges, but they don't throw out all the charges. In this case, Burdick threw out all the charges, although, again, they can immediately be refiled, and that's apparently what's going on. So one wonders how endless this process is going to be. That's why I wasn't so optimistic about it. And I'm checking SantaCruz11.org, and we're seeing, yeah, SantaCruz11.org has its own website, and it has some recent posts on it, as well as a petition to sign if you're supportive of dropping these charges. And I encourage everyone to do that. This is going to be a long struggle to fight back, and it's only just beginning. If any organizations you're a part of, love to have them sign on to this demand that the district attorney start spending, I mean, their time on real crime, stabbings, murders, robberies, instead of political crimes, which is whatever displeases the city council, the board of supervisors, Susan Mariello, the chief administrative officer of the county, or police chief Vogel, or Sheriff Wowak. These should not be the consideration for whether a person is considered to be a criminal. It's whether they're committing real crimes or not. And in this case, vacant buildings are the crime, in my view. And that's my story, and I'm sticking to it. Let's hear some more from the Project Connect days. And again, we're soon going to be having a visit from Uncle Dennis. He'll be with us for 3 hours to play monotonous 60s and 70s music. Actually, it's not monotonous. It's quite quite tuneful for all, and I even enjoy it at times, but we'll see what's cooking. He also gives reports on environmental issues and stuff that I rarely listen to but probably should, and perhaps you should too.
We're outside again, and it's about 12:25, and we have some folks who are talking with Bob Lee, the DA.
And Bob Lee is, of course, the prime DA of Santa Cruz, and he's the person who a lot of attention has been focused on because he controls whether there's going to be prosecutions in the Santa Cruz 11 case, back in all cases. He's got the final say, as I understand it. And he was walking about. He's a tall, friendly-looking figure, and he's a friendly guy, actually. I've talked to him, personable fellow, on a number of occasions. We tried to ask him some questions, and you'll hear me asking him questions about 647E, which is a penal code that has to do with lodging, which Linda LeMaster, a longtime activist, has been on my show a number of times, is facing 6 months in jail for, which Gary Johnson, Ground Zero Gary, as I call him, has already been sentenced to 2 years for, which Ed Fry and Gary Johnson are appealing six-month sentences for, which many Occupy Santa Cruz activists have been arrested for and cited for, which is essentially says that if you're sitting in a place that they don't want you to be, they call you lodging, a lodger, and they arrest you, and you have to deal with all kinds of court crap. And for Bob Lee to show up at a homeless event where people are getting those kinds of tickets when the police or the sheriffs don't want them to be in a certain place, but they have no legal way to remove them and no real opportunities or alternatives to offer them, to me is really an act of some chutzpah, some nerve, if you will. Let's hear this conversation. There's not, I unfortunately, because of the fact that I'm facing charges, I tend to be a little more circumspect in how I present myself in public, perhaps than I should be. I think I need to be more outspoken, but I do what I can.
Section 8 housing going on. And we have a shelter volunteer chatting here with the DA.
And what was the requirement? Was to keep you on it? Or?
They want you to always say where you are and just keep informing them. If they send you something, say, yes, I still want it. And anything changed, anything married, children, yeah. So I did it.
How did they communicate you? Did you keep a address or did you come back?
Because I was homeless, my mail went to the shelter. If it wasn't for their mail, I wouldn't know.
So somebody didn't have the possibility have a mailing address? Or
the guy is talking about the mailing address is Bob Lee.
They need to have one. Because see, there's a lot of people on Social Security. Where are your checks
going
to go?
Where are your checks going to go? Right.
Pretty soon there won't be any checks.
Electronic.
Electronic deposit. Need a place for that to happen.
The if it wasn't for the mail-in service at the time, I would not known about housing and lost my paper. So now I'm off the street.
There's a charge, right, for this. You have 50 cents to pay for mail to, or $5 a month, I think it is now.
Five, but see, I don't do my mail-in no more. I got my own little mail-in address. But yeah, I was on that list for about 7 years.
You tried the free voicemail and didn't work out for you?
Well, mine did, and I kept up on it. But what it was, I keep forgetting I was there or something like that. Uh-huh. And certain times they called and I messed up my number, but it was working for me, too.
Uh-huh.
And then as you get a little money, talk about a little cell phone.
Ever been ticketed for sleeping outside?
No.
Good. I'm glad to hear it.
In somewhere, I used to couch surf a lot. That's what happened to me.
Because?
I was with grandchildren. They're 2 and 4. Seven. I don't want them out there.
Yeah, I hear you. I hear you.
Kind of sleeping in people's cars with them, maybe, and the house.
But that's illegal in the city and county of Santa Cruz.
What, sleeping in cars?
Sleeping in cars is a violation, and so is...
one here at the time.
Yeah, the DA...
We were surfing people.
Bob here has been prosecuting people who were sleeping on the courthouse steps in protest.
Oh, I didn't know that. Okay.
But any more of those in the works, Bob, at this point, or...
That's your
friend, Joe. Sorry.
Bob is not answering that question. And his entourage moves off. So I'm in the food line now, right outside Conference Room C. It's around 12:30. Bob Lee is, a few moments ago, he was still standing around on the corner, glad-handing, or kind of just glad-handing. He was making himself visible in his business suit, and smiling and nodding sagely and so forth, but not answering any of the questions that I put here. Similarly with Monica Martinez, she did not want to speak into a microphone about her policies, which made me feel that my earlier friendly interaction with her might be deceiving to me, and I might be letting myself go. We're talking to a much ticketed woman who's trying to eat spaghetti, and her mouth is probably full. What are these three tickets?
One for bedding, sitting on my bed, and two for camping. At 12:45 and then at 8:30 the same day, and then I got a ticket at 1 o'clock two nights ago.
These are all at night?
Yes, uh-huh.
And where were you, if you don't mind saying?
On the river, on one side of the river, then the other side of the river, and then I was on the river again.
To avail yourself of the wonderful homeless lack of services center.
I was there while it was raining, but then there was no place to be. I had to go sleep, and so I went and laid on the river where there's patrol because I feel more safe.
It's illegal to sleep in Santa Cruz. Hasn't anybody told you
that? I take 14 kinds of medicine a day, and if I have to.
How old are you?
57.
And what is your ailment?
I'm a heart patient, congestive heart failure. And
your name, of course, is?
Diane P. Gordon.
And you were part of the Peace Camp 2010 protest.
Yeah, certainly.
And is this the same police officers have been doing this to you, or different ones?
Different ones now. It was before, it was the city police. So
did you tell them that there was no shelter?
They know. They know everything about, they know.
Did they insist you move as well as ticketing you?
They said I had to leave soon, they put it that way, and I stayed till it got daylight. But they told me that I would be placed in jail if I was there when they returned.
Free shelter?
No. I don't want to. I don't like jail. I can't imagine.
You've been talking with?
Yeah, Diane Patricia Gordon.
This happened when?
The last week. Three tickets. Yeah.
Three tickets in the last week.
Yeah, since Armory closed, since the nighttime shelter closed, three tickets. Immediately, they ticketed everybody. 100 people went out on the street. We all started getting tickets. All of us did.
How many other people did you know got tickets?
Everybody I know got tickets.
Well, they want to be fair. Give it to everyone, you know.
Yeah.
So nobody gets left out.
Yeah, and I would say probably 60 or 70 of us got tickets, yeah. A lot of high numbers. A lot of people just tear them up and they don't care, but I do. I don't want to be a criminal just because I'm sleepy. All the medicines they give me, if I don't take them, I'll die. If I do take them, I can't move around. There's no trespassing signs everywhere, no place to sit everywhere, so just no place to sleep, no place to sit, no place. So I don't know. My health is pretty important to me. Just if I could sit down and my health be better, or if I could sleep and I could live, I mean, it's a big thing.
I think you've said it all.
Thank you.
Thanks, Diana. We're talking with
Sharon King.
And Sharon, you're off for Cabrillo in your silk screening class?
Well, yes, I'm TA for Tobin Keller's silk screening class.
And you had a good time here today.
Yes, I helped a young man from Mexico who works the strawberry fields 6 months a year. and hasn't had, well, he hasn't had work for 6 months because he works the strawberry fields, and he is, he's never drunk a drink in his life or smoked a cigarette, and he has 4 kids and a wife in Mexico, and doesn't speak English. And
did you turn him in to Sheriff Wowak as an illegal immigrant, perhaps?
And so we, he got some great dental care, and he is getting a voucher to go to a thrift store and get some clothes for his family, and I'm going to go get some too, and we're going to send a bunch of clothes down there, and he wants a haircut, and he'd like to talk to someone about housing, but he's smart as a whip. He's smarter than I am.
Tú hablas español, ¿verdad?
Sí, bastante bien para hablar con él.
Ayudarle
a mucho.
You helped him a lot.
Sí,
I helped you a lot.
¿Tú me ayudaste? ¿Cómo?
I'm asking, did this help you as well as help him?
Of course.
You were a volunteer with one of them volunteer t-shirts on?
Yes.
But now you're in your civilian clothes.
That's right. And I didn't volunteer with any organization. Anyone can volunteer. You don't have to belong to any organization to do that. You just get on the internet and you go to Homeless
Project Connect.
Homeless Project Connect. And you say, it says contact, and you contact them and you say you want to volunteer. You don't have to be a member of an organization. All you have to do is want to connect.
And get access to a computer. If you're homeless, that's a little more difficult, but not always impossible.
Isn't it true that there are computers in libraries?
It is true, but they are limited in their how you can use them. They're limited in terms of the hours of accessibility, and the library is, for my money, one of the best resources, though they attempted to arrest me once for giving flyers in the antechamber of a library.
Excuse me. What I meant was, if you wanted to volunteer and you could get access to a computer.
And what I said was that you can do that in a library, but it's a limited access. But yeah, I mean, there is a way to do that. So if you are homeless and listening to this broadcast, or housed for that matter, or whatever, you go check out Project Homeless Connect in Santa Cruz. I don't know if they're active much of the rest of the year. I think this is their one big shot, but I could be wrong.
I also would imagine that you could go to any organization that actually gives services to people in Santa Cruz County and tell them that you wanted to be involved with Project Homeless Connect, and they would give you a phone number.
Indeed. All you have to do then would panhandle 50 cents to make a phone call.
Excuse me?
Then you would just have to, if you were homeless, panhandle.
I'm not talking about homeless people. I'm talking about people who want to help as a volunteer for Project Homeless Connect.
And those
the
might
way
include.
I did,
mm-hmm.
The way
might include homeless people. In other words, homeless might also want to be volunteers and do what you did.
I have no idea.
I think some are actually doing that today.
Uh-huh.
I've seen homeless folks who are, you know, volunteers as well.
Well, that's great. I hope that they realize that there are a lot of organizations in Santa Cruz County that can help them connect, even with Project Connect. That's what this is all about.
Well, you've been connected. Connected today. Who we've been talking with?
Sharon King.
Thank you, Sharon.
Thank you.
And sounds like a naive, somewhat defensive person who has some fantasies about the extent of the services that are provided in Santa Cruz City and County for homeless people, which, as far as shelter goes, amount to a drop in the bucket. And the criminalization, the amount of energy put into criminalization far outweighs the energy put into homeless services, has been my experience. Because, after all, merchants making sure their streets are cleansed of the socially undesirable is more important than human rights or human services for people who need them. That seems to be the situation and the problem, and it's up to us to change it. So, it's 8 o'clock, and I'm expecting at any moment that Uncle Dennis is going to burst in through the doors with some of his usual regimentagem. And he'll be perhaps giving us a description of what's coming up for him. There's stuff coming up for us. I believe May 1st there's a series of protests that are going to be happening on campus and that are also going to be happening downtown. There's going to be sort of a convergence at the post office at 5:30, as I understand it. And I'll be talking more about that when I come back on Sunday at 9:30 in the a.m. So stay with me. Might have another interview or two to run by you, because Dennis seems to be a bit late today, but I'm sure he's going to come rolling in. He's, who knows, maybe he's enjoying the good weather. No more interviews at the moment, but again, I encourage people to take a look at this week's Good Times. It actually has more political information than the Week Santa Cruz Weekly, which is pretty weak, the Weekly. The one good thing about the Santa Cruz Weekly, for once last week, it actually had a cartoon by Stephen DeCinzo, who I don't have a lot of... Well, he doesn't like me much, but I find his caricatures of the city council really funny, accurate, and on target a lot. He does get dissed by some letter writer who doesn't like DeCinzo, accuses him of being inaccurate and unfactual on the desal issue. DeCinzo characterizes the city council as steamrolling over opposition to its $130 million boondoggle, but I think that's exactly what it's doing. And Don Lane's gabble about helping to setting up its city council's own initiative for a democratic process was done only after massive pressure by opponents of DSAL, and Lane still refuses to do, which is the obvious thing, which is to put an initiative or a city charter amendment on the ballot as a city council, which would bind the future city councils. He doesn't want to do that because I think there are those in the city council that want to overturn and raise up again the DSAL issue even after the voters have voted it out. And, you know, and people will say, well, they can always vote it out again. But there's a difference between an initiative which takes 6 months, which allows you 6 months to get signatures, and that's what people who are now putting the DSAL charter amendment on the ballot are doing, and a referendum, which is an attempt, which when you try to reverse a city council vote, you only get 1 month to do that. Very hard to do, rarely done. I don't know if it's ever been successfully done in opposition to city council. City council usually, on occasion, I think it's surrendered to a referendum initiative. But more frequently, when you get a, you get the referendum people surrendering, as in the De Anza rent control scam,